It's the golden age of graphic literature, and graphic lit is turning to the classics.
I think we're living in this golden age, actually, of comic art and illustration and graphic novels. There is so much talent out there, and the art forms are being taken in such amazing new directions, and it's really a golden age. And some artists have been, for a while now, adapting classic literature into comic and illustrated form.
That's Russ Kick. He's the editor of The Graphic Canon, a two-volume set of the Western world's greatest literature, rendered in graphic novel form. Writer's Voice associate producer Drew Adamick talks with Kick in our first segment. And recently, the Congress finally passed the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, and it includes protections the House previously stripped out, protections for Native American women and lesbians.
At this point, the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act of 2012, it's House Resolution 4970, is something that has to be restored to its original form before it should be passed, and I don't know how that's going to happen.
That's Louise Erdrich. We re-air my October 2012 interview with Erdrich about her novel, The Roundhouse. It's about the brutal rape and beating of a Native American woman and her struggle for justice against her non-Native perpetrator. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
The Graphic Canon, the world's greatest literature as comics and visuals, is a three-volume set of some of humanity's greatest stories illustrated by over 200 graphic, comic, and illustrative artists. In it, each of the selected stories of the canon are illustrated by a different artist. This gives the reader literally hundreds of new ways of looking at familiar stories. This collection is a striking and enjoyable testament to the combined storytelling power of visual art and written literature that will take readers years to truly understand and enjoy. Starting with the story of Gilgamesh in Volume 1, and ending with David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest in Volume 3, the Graphic Canon is a fascinating and beautiful collection with a wide variety of artistic and storytelling styles. But this collection is different from most literary anthologies in that it offers an exceptional range of interpretations of unexpected works like the only known Mayan play, Darwin's Origin of Species, and the Tibetan Book of the Dead. The Graphic Canon aims to be a repository not only of humanity's most important and timeless stories, but serves as an encyclopedia of different artistic styles. Artistic contributors include famous comic and graphic artists like Will Eisner, Robert Crumb, and Gris Grimley. Editor Russ Kick is a writer, editor, and publisher. He conceived, gathered, and assembled the massive collection. The first two volumes have already been released, and the third and final book is slated for a May release. I spoke to Russ Kick about the rules he gave for artists when assembling this collection, how words and images work together in storytelling, and which story he didn't get to include in this anthology. This is such a broad and ambitious project. Can you talk a little bit about, broadly speaking, these first two volumes and soon to be third volume, how they came to exist and where their genesis comes from?
Well, I think we're living in this golden age, actually, of comic art and illustration and graphic novels. There is so much talent out there, and the art forms are being taken in such amazing new directions, and it's really a golden age. And some artists have been, for a while now, adapting classic literature into comic and illustrated form. I thought it's time to really, just do this upright, to make a huge, like, Norton anthology style of literature, the huge brick-like books, anthologies of literature through the ages that are used in colleges, to just apply that basic idea to graphically adapted literature. The idea just hit me one day in the graphic novel section of a bookstore when I saw, yet another graphic adaptation. Someone had done The Trial by Kafka, as a standalone book, and I thought, Now, there needs to be just a huge anthology of this kind of material.
And you've included in this collection all sorts of things that are not considered part of the canon. So you have science text and philosophical text and poetry and ancient Inca or Mayan plays, rather. So what was your process moving forward from this original idea of what would be included in this collection?
I knew it was important to start with the obvious ones. You know, there's just the A-list of world literature, you know, like The Odyssey, Paradise Lost, Moby Dick, Pride and Prejudice, Huckleberry Finn. You know, there were some obvious books and works that had to be in there, or they would just be glaring omissions. That was kind of a starting point. And then, yeah, I like kind of expanding things, you know, and going off on tangents and, you know, otherwise kind of bringing in the unexpected, but things that still kind of fit, you know, things that still really are or should be part of the canon of literature. And so, yeah, I brought in some works of philosophy and On the Origin of Species by Darwin, children's literature, which I think is actually, you know, the best children's literature actually does rank up there with great literature, period. So there are things like Alice in Wonderland and some fairy tales by Hans Christian Andersen. So, yeah, I kept on the lookout for the unexpected nooks and crannies of the canon.
But there are two parts to these. And when I talk about the collection, at the moment I'm talking about volumes 1 and 2 of the Graphic Canon, but there is a third volume coming out. There are two parts to this series, which is the stories that are included as part of the canon and the artists that tell these stories. Can you talk a little bit about your process of finding and choosing the artists and their work to include in this? Because there are some really interesting pairings.
Yeah, and also when you mentioned the three volumes, I do want to say that this is intended as a three-volume set because it runs chronologically. Actually, volume one starts with the ancient literature. You know, starts with the Epic of Gilgamesh, the earliest known story, and goes all the way through the Middle Ages, through Shakespeare, and ends in the late 1700s. And then Volume 2 picks right up at the turn of the century, at the beginning of the 1800s, with the Romantic poets, and proceeds all the way through the 1800s to the decadent end of the century with Oscar Wilde. And so, yeah, Volume 3, that's about to come out in May, is the 20th century, starting right at the turn of the century and going through 1996 with Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Now, about finding the artists, I, of course, started with my personal favorites. You know, I approached the artists I liked. And then I did a lot of searching and read a lot of other comics anthologies and a lot of looking online. Found a lot of just amazing artists who are underexposed. You know, they haven't been widely published at all. And yet, they're amazing. They have their own unique, easily identifiable style, you know, their own vision and great technical skill. So I would, you know, hone in on those and ask them to join in. And you know, I did a lot of following of links because a lot of artists will like list their colleagues and their friends who are also comics artists and illustrators and such. And so I would keep hopping around and just finding all these amazing artists and asking them to be part of the project. And not everyone wanted to, you know, some of them just weren't into literature, you know, it just isn't their cup of tea, and so they declined. But the thing is, the artists who did want to be part of it generally are the ones who love literature. You know, they wanted to do multiple works. They were so excited about this. So it was nice in that way because I got the most the most enthusiastic contributors.
When you approached artists for this collection, what were the rules for them? Did you apply any limits on them or their relationship to the material and what they could and couldn't do with these stories?
There were page limits, of course, because we were just trying to pack so much in that there had to be page limits. But as far as like the broader question, actually, I asked them to stick close to the material. You know, I told them that they shouldn't be making up new adventures for the characters, or they shouldn't be changing the setting into the far future and, you know, make Huckleberry Finn into a science fiction tale or something like that. I asked them to be true to the work, but at the same time, I told them they had absolute free rein of how to handle it artistically, how to handle it visually. Any style, any approach, anything they wanted to do was fine. And they were very appreciative of that. They loved having that free rein. And I think that's why the books ended up with so much great work.
In doing your own research, you must have just come across a ton of new material and discovered all sorts of things about the material, the canon that were new to you. Can you talk a little bit about what your process was like becoming so involved in these stories over time?
Each adaptation in the volumes has a short intro by me. There's 55 pieces in Volume 1, 51 in Volume 2, and 81 in Volume 3. Yeah, I set the stage for each one by telling something about the work of literature, you know, why it's important and what it's about. And then, you know, I tell a little about the artist and how they approached it. And I also try to keep it very interesting. You know, I mean, it could be very dry intros, but I wanted to make them fun to read and filled with interesting facts. So, yeah, I got quite an education myself. I mean, I was already familiar with a lot of the material, but still, delving into all of this, researching the intros just opened up all kinds of fascinating worlds. I mean, I for example, I was very surprised to learn that Harold Bloom, who is a very controversial figure, but he is essentially the leading expert on Western literature. He is the authority on it, and not everyone likes his opinions and views, but you can't really argue with his authoritativeness. And he wrote about Hans Christian Andersen, who is famous for his, well, what we call fairy tales, but are probably more accurately called tales for children. He said that Hans Christian Andersen is actually, his writing is on a par with Tolstoy, which just floored me. You know, mostly the translations that are around, which are a lot of older translations, don't do justice. They watered him down. They took out the nuances, took out some of the dark humor, some of those socio-political insights. So, you know, that was just something that I thought was really fascinating to learn. And another thing that pops to mind is learning the history of the Bronte family. Because here you have several siblings, including these three sisters, Emily Bronte, Charlotte, and Anne, who each wrote a classic work of literature at the same time. It's maybe one of the most amazing creative feats in history that, you know, these girls who at the time, girls, of course, were not given much of an education, and they had some, but really not much, and they also didn't have much worldly experience. They kind of lived a sheltered life. And yet, all three of them, at the same time, produced classic novels, you know, including, of course, Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, which are, you know, two of the A-lists of world literature. And it's hard to imagine how that's even possible. And that family was also pretty tragic, too, because it turns out that all six of the siblings died before they were 40.
You are listening to Writer's Voice. I am Drew Adamack, and today I am speaking to Russ Kick, the editor of the Graphic Canon, Volumes 1, 2, and 3. I want to go back a little bit, because you mentioned this is a golden age of graphic novels and illustration. And this is an important set of stories, this canon. And you've combined the two. When you did that and when you conceived this collection, who did you see as the natural audience for something like this?
That's a good question, because I felt like there was an audience for this, but I'm not sure. I feel like there's overlapping audiences. There's the people who are more into comics and graphic novels in general, and I'm thinking, you know, they will enjoy seeing what happens when all these great artists, you know, use the classic works of literature as their basis, you know, and base their art on the greatest stories that have ever been told. And then you do have the people who are more into literature, you know, coming at it from that angle, who I think would enjoy it. Well, in fact, I know they do enjoy it. I've seen it myself when they see the books. They do enjoy this approach, but the trick is kind of convincing them to give it a chance in the first place, you know, because, you know, frankly, comic art and illustration is kind of looked down upon, at least in our country. It's given more of a chance in some other countries, but there's a stigma to it here. But I've noticed people who are into literature love it when they finally get a look at it. And then you have this kind of general audience of, it's interesting, it's like people who are not really, they're intelligent, and they're readers, but they're not really into classic literature. And they're not really into graphic novels or comics, but they do like to read, and they are passingly familiar with the great works of literature. And I've seen a bunch of people like this who I show them the book, and their eyes light up. They just love it. And they think, part of it is they think of this as a way to really catch up on world literature, which I hadn't really fully thought of that angle while I was creating it, but it kind of it works in that way too. Definitely, you can find out, you know, through the introductions, and then of course through the illustrated adaptations, you can get a really nice quick survey of world literature.
This collection, and one of the reasons, well, there are two things. It got me really excited because it's a beautiful example of the relationship, the storytelling power and the relationship between words and images in a more thoughtful way than, say, television or the movies. Will you talk a little bit about the relationship and how you see the relationship between words and images and conveying these sort of timeless stories?
There's so many different ways, you know. It's kind of as an encyclopedia of different ways to merge art and words, because you have kind of your classic straightforward style of comics, which is sequentially done, and there are word balloons, and then you have full page illustrations, and you have some works that are a series of full page illustrations that actually go in sequence. And so in the series, you know, in the space of like 10 or 12 full-page illustrations, essentially tell you the basics of the story. And a lot of those also have, you know, really beautiful hand lettering done by the artist worked in there. And then, you know, there are all these hybrids that I can't even really describe, really creative ways artists came up of combining words and images that are not, you know, they're not strictly speaking, I guess, sequential comics, but they are also, they're not simply text with accompanying illustrations. They're kind of, they're merged in various ways. So it's really exciting to see these various ways of, you know, of telling stories visually. And then you have some that don't even have words. There are some, I guess you would call them silent comics in there that, like, I'm blanking here.
I actually picked out three, and that was going to be one of my next question. While there is a relationship, while there's a very powerful relationship between words and images, I thought some of the most powerful stories in here and some of the most powerful storytelling in here were examples like, you know, Beowulf or the Tibetan Book of the Dead or the Plato Symposium that don't have words to them, but they still convey
right.
a real rich storytelling vein. And this, it's a really powerful example of the different ways to tell a story, that there is no one set way to tell a great story. Is that mm-hmm. something that you found while you were gathering these pieces? And how do you see that play out throughout this whole collection?
Yeah, I wanted pieces in there that didn't have any words with them. You know, in those cases, it does help especially to have the little introductions to set the stage for exactly what you're seeing. But then, yeah, it's amazing to see just how powerful it can be without any text at all. And you do have various approaches like Beowulf, as you mentioned, which is, it is a comic. It's done in a very, you know, very high art illustrative style, but it is a sequential comic with panels, but no words. And then you have the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is done as a series of full-page illustrations and two-page spreads alternating. Yeah, there are no words there. There's just the artist's conception of what the Book of the Dead talks about, which is, of course, you know, the in-between stage of lifetimes, so between when you die and when you are reborn. There are these stages you go through, and so she just ran with it. And so, yeah, I think it does show that you can tell these stories without even using any of the original words that the authors wrote, which it kind of seems like a paradox, but it happens many times. You know, there is, in Volume 2, there's Oliver Twist, done without words, and there's an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which is Ambrose Bierce, and done with no words, just as a series of painted comics panels. And then you'll see a bunch of it also in Volume 3. There's going to be several that don't have words either. And yeah, I think that's an interesting aspect of the book that is definitely in there.
There's an expression that you've used in this interview and that you use in the book that I found to have sort of two meanings, and that's this idea of sequential art, that the comics themselves are sequential in the way that some of them are told with the panels. But this is also in the broader sense of human art, sequential art, because you've put it together chronologically. And what does that mean for you, both as individual pieces as an entire collection, this idea of sequential art?
I think I see what you're saying, because I've had the same thought, and I think maybe others have said this, that in the sense, there is only one story. Every book, every short story, everything is just part of this gigantic book that the human race is writing. So, you know, and it's kind of that's a more interesting esoteric way to look at it. And I do view it that way sometimes, that there's this epic narrative unfolding over the centuries, over the millennia. And so that was why the graphic canon, the idea was always it was going to be chronological. I mean, there was never any doubt in my mind, and the publisher was the same way. I mean, there was no debating of, grouping it by theme or by genre or anything like that. It was always going to be unfolding across time. You know, you would start with Beowulf. You would start with Gilgamesh, you know, then go through the ancient Greeks, the ancient Hebrews, you know, go through the Middle Ages, Shakespeare, the 19th century, the 20th century. And so, yeah, you get to notice some things, you know, you get to notice the way stories have changed, the way they're being told has changed. But probably the more interesting thing is you get to see how much of it's the same, how many of the themes and the concerns are absolutely the same across the millennia, you know, that that shows up right in Gilgamesh, which is our oldest surviving work of literature. There's all this stuff there about death and mortality and having to face your own death. And there's very heavy theme of friendship, of male bonding and what friendship means. And there are also sex scenes, which I think is fascinating. The sex in literature is not just some decadent 20th century invention. It was literally in the first work of literature. There are sex scenes. It's been there since day one. So, yeah, you do get to discover all that because everything is laid out in chronological sequence.
You are listening to Writer's Voice. I am Drew Adamack, and today I am speaking to Russ Kick, the editor of the Graphic Canon, Volumes 1, 2, and 3. Were there things that were difficult not to include, or were there things that you struggled with, for example, maybe Lincoln's Gettysburg Address that you wanted to put in and weren't able to, or were there things that were sort of on the border for you?
I mean, I look back and I think, even though there are pretty close to 200 pieces across the three volumes, it's like, oh, I just scratched the surface here. I mean, you could start naming so many things that should have been in there. And of course, that's what sequels are for. So, not like they'll never get done, but, a lot of anthology editing comes down to kind of the luck of the draw and kind of which artists are willing to take part and which works they want to do. And, some things that I wanted in there didn't make it in there. For example, one of my favorite works of literature ever is In Search of Lost Time by Proust, and nobody wanted to do it. I don't know if they were intimidated, by 1.5 million words or what. That didn't get chosen. And so, I even tried to kind of, suggest it to some artists specifically and push it a little, but in the end, I always went with their wishes. So there are a bunch that I wish had, and I suppose, I don't know, maybe if there were 10 volumes, seriously, I could feel like I really... really captured a good chunk of it. But that's just the sign of the wealth of literature that is out there.
What do you want readers to take away from this collection? I mean, because it is such a sort of an innovative way of telling these stories.
I mean, I suppose at one level, there's kind of an obvious answer that's partly true, which is, that it would be great if this led people to read the original works in their entirety. That would be a great side effect. But what I was really trying to do was create kind of a self-enclosed work here. In other words, even if you never went past the Graphic Canon, even if you never went back to the original works, you would still be fulfilled by the Graphic Canon. It would still, it stands on its own. That's part of the answer, too. Another part of the answer, I mean, there are really several agendas going on here. So there's also the agenda of really showing what comics and the graphic arts, illustrative arts can do to really showcase their potential and to take them in new directions. And because there are some very, I think some, just even if you forget that we're talking about classic literature, even if you're looking at it strictly from the artistic standpoint, there are some really groundbreaking pieces across the three volumes that really break new ground for comic art in general. So, there's kind of all this stuff going on at once, and I hope that answers your question.
Thank you so much for joining us, Russ Kick.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Drew Adamack spoke with Russ Kick about the Graphic Canon earlier this month. Next up, Louise Erdrich's The Roundhouse. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On March 7th, President Obama signed the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. At his side was the original author of the act as passed in 1994, Joe Biden. The reauthorization did not come easy. Last year, Republicans in the House took out the expansion of certain protections to gay couples and Native American women that were in the Senate version of the bill. But finally, in February, a minority of House Republicans joined Democrats to adopt the Senate version, and the act passed by a vote of 286 to 138. Indigenous women in the U.S. experienced some of the highest rates of sexual assault in the country. Almost half of all Native American women have been raped, beaten, or stalked by an intimate partner. One in three will be raped in their lifetime. And 86% of the assaults on them are committed by non-Native men. Now, for the first time, the law closes the loophole that exempted non-Native perpetrators from tribal jurisdiction. Louise Erdrich's latest novel, The Roundhouse, covers some of this territory. It's the story of the brutal rape of a Native American woman and how the victim's young son takes on the task of bringing his mother's assailant to justice. I spoke with Erdrich in 2012. In Louise Erdrich's novel, The Roundhouse, a boy finds out that his mother has been horribly assaulted. He sets out to find out who her killer is so he can be brought to justice. But it's an Indian reservation in North Dakota in the 1980s, and there is no justice for Native Americans, especially if they've been assaulted by a white man. Erdrich returns to the place where she set some of her earlier novels, like The Plague of Doves, about which we spoke with her in 2008. I've long been a fan of Louise Erdrich's work, her stunning prose and memorable characters. And, in my humble opinion, with The Roundhouse, she's hit the literary ball out of the park. It's a masterful exploration of trauma and healing, although there is no anodyne ending. That's because Erdrich wants us to know, perpetrated against Native Americans, and especially against women on the reservations, continues unabated, and justice is still elusive. This past year, Senate Republicans stripped provisions from the Violence Against Women Act that had made it easier for Native American women to report abuse, provisions the Obama administration strongly supported. Louise Erdrich is the author of 14 novels, including The Bingo Palace, Love Medicine, and The Beat Queen, as well as numerous short stories, poetry, and nonfiction. The Roundhouse is out from HarperCollins. Well, Louise Erdrich, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back, as a matter of fact.
Right.
We talked with you last about your book, The Plague of Doves.
Right.
And in this book, you return to the setting of The Plague of Doves, but at a later time. Then it was the early years of the 20th century, and this one takes place toward the end in 1988. Both novels have a terrible act of violence and injustice at their center. Could you talk a little bit about the lineage between the two books?
The narrator of The Roundhouse is the son of Judge Coates and his wife, Geraldine, who get married at the end of The Plague of Doves. The Plague of Doves actually goes from the turn of the last century into the 1970s. So this book takes up in 1988, and we have a young 13-year-old narrator who is really very secure in his family, really a loving kid, you know, an ordinary kid, as he describes himself, who likes to think of himself as a little wild, but who really values his family so deeply. And so this act of violence is going to propel him into an entirely new relationship with his parents, with his friends, and his entire world is going to change in the course of one summer.
He's a very compelling character, as a matter of fact. 13-year-old Joe Coutts finds out that his mother, Geraldine, has been brutally assaulted. In fact, she's been raped. Tell us a little bit about what's going on without giving away too much of the book.
If she had been given a clear route to justice, after this assault, perhaps things would have gone differently. But with this assault, she, in fact, finds with her husband, who is a judge, tribal judge, that justice is very difficult to obtain on the reservation. Now, I knew about this situation for many years before writing the book, and I was tremendously, I guess anybody would be shocked to know that one of three Native women will suffer sexual violence in their lifetimes. About 88% of those acts of sexual violence are committed by non-Natives. Almost none of them are able to be prosecuted because of a tangle of laws that keep things up in the air in terms of who has to prosecute, who is going to be handling the case. It's all jurisdictional issues. These laws make it very difficult to prosecute such crimes of sexual violence. Plus, non-Native people are not subject to be prosecuted by tribal courts. So the tribal court system, in the first place, can't prosecute many people who commit these crimes.
Is that because it can only prosecute people who are from the reservation itself?
Exactly. And they can only prosecute their own tribal members. Now, this was a right that was taken away in a case called Oliphant versus Suquamish. And there has been some movement in the Senate and in Congress to restore some of this sovereignty to tribal nations so that they can at least get some justice moving on reservations. But it's been blocked in the House. So, you know, we still have the same problem now in 2012 that has been going on since even before 1988. I actually chose 1988 because of Joe's interest in Star Trek: The Next Generation. That was the first. That was the first one, year that the season was out in 1987, 1988. So I wanted him to be able to talk about his favorite character, Worf.
And we're talking with Louise Erdrich about her new novel, The Roundhouse. It just won the National Book Award in Fiction. I asked Erdrich if anything is being done to remedy the inability of tribal members to sue assailants who live off the reservation.
So restorative justice needs to go through Congress. And that has been, there's a bill sponsored by Senator Leahy that restores some of that sovereignty, but only a limited sovereignty so that cases of sexual violence could be prosecuted by tribal courts. It's not a full fix of that case, but it's a partial fix. And also President Obama he's been extraordinarily knowledgeable about Native issues, and he has signed into law an act which would very much help women to, it's the Tribal Law and Order Act, and he has really been an advocate for Native people and for Native women.
Wow, this is something I don't think that's very well known.
I don't think it is well known. He also signed the Indigenous Rights Declaration of Human Rights, Indigenous Human Rights, which was in process for many, many years through the UN, and our country was the very last to sign. And he did it. He's had Native people working in the White House. I can't say enough about him. I've been astonished at his knowledge of what's going on. He's supported Indigenous language survival. He's done all sorts of things that benefit Native people. He's even given his own money to tribal colleges.
Wow, that's amazing. And this is on top of course, as we know, generations of the most horrendous injustice. A line that you connect in the two books, particularly, I mean, throughout many of the books that you have written, the issues of justice and injustice are ones that you very much delve into. And in this book here, we have Joe, this 13-year-old boy, who decides that justice is not going to come the normal way. He takes it on. Tell us about some of the conundrums that this presents both to him and to his father and his mother.
Well, Joe, of course, is very protective of his mom. I mean, he doesn't start that way. It has to evolve into growing up to some degree, and it's too fast for him. You know, he goes straight from being a kid whose parents are the protective ones, into a world where he understands that they cannot provide protection for him. So that at a very immature age, he feels he needs to take upon himself some decisions about justice that really should never be in his realm. And he's one of a bunch of kids, a bunch of boys, and their main method of transportation, of course, is their bicycles. And they get into a lot of trouble. I really enjoyed writing these guys. I felt very close to them throughout the whole book. And I guess because I was a tomboy, I wrote them into getting into heroic scrapes and troubles and doing things that were just typically like dorky boys. So there's a lot that's actually funny in the book, and although it's a very serious book about the relationship between Joe and his mother and his father, it's also funny.
It's not just funny. I've loved your work ever since.
Oh, thank you.
I've been reading your work for decades.
Oh, thank you.
And I felt that this was, you know, if I can say it, I felt that this was one of, if not your best, of them all. It's hard to say because I've loved every single one, but...
Oh, that's so kind. Thanks.
This one was so powerful. And yes, it was funny. It was completely gripping. And it really tells a story that, a story of justice, injustice, and even revenge, the search for justice that has a really tremendous emotional impact. And his mother, talk a little bit more about her. I mean, she has been so traumatized. She withdraws. She leaves her family emotionally to be on their own. One struggles with this. I struggled with this. I felt like, well, she's got a son. She's responsible to him. What's happened here?
I think very often one that crime such as this is looked upon as really the woman's job to get over it. And especially then, you know, there was not a lot of dialogue or a lot of talk about how one understands post-traumatic stress or how one begins to heal. And she did it the only way she knew how to heal, which was to utterly withdraw into herself. And this is terrifying, of course, to her son and to her husband. But she also has, it turns out, very important reasons for maintaining a silence about this tremendous violence. She's protecting another woman and a child, as it turns out. And, you know, without giving anything away, there is this silence from her in the beginning that is broken by the middle of the book.
Now, the roundhouse of the title, this is a very central place of action. I felt that this was not only a physical place, but a spiritual place as well. I wonder if you could talk about the roundhouse.
It is a spiritual place. And, of course, the circular shape is indicative and reminiscent of all of the changes in the seasons, the growth patterns in the natural world, the way the great, you know, the great circle of the sky, everything is embodied within this particular structure, so that it's a very sacred structure to the Ojibwe, and that's where ceremonies are held. So for this old space to be violated is also an act that symbolically violates an entire people. And it has been said many times that when a nation is never truly conquered till the hearts of its women are on the ground. And that's what's happening. You know, this cycle of violence is so destructive, not only to women, but to entire families.
Yeah, you know, in the papers, I mean, there's been recently a lot about domestic violence and sexual abuse on Indian reservations. And I think most people get the idea that it's Native American on Native American. So that when you say, as you did earlier, that 88% of the violence is committed by people who are not of the reservation, mm-hmm. talk a little bit about the perception and what this violence does, how it actually impacts whole communities.
One of the reasons it appears in newspapers that to be Native violence is that one says there'll be a line that says most of these acts of violence are committed by family members, and one doesn't immediately think, well, you know, this woman has married a non-Native person or is a boyfriend who's non-Native. So, yeah, there plenty of Native families have non-Native people in the family. So these people who should be subject to laws on the reservation and are not subject to laws on the reservation are the focus of those particular changes and fixes that should be made in the Oliphant Law. So that's the people that who are being referred to.
And when you say that the women are being destroyed, I mean, it's almost, one thinks of the rapes in Bosnia or in the mm-hmm. Congo. I mean, connect this to the larger system of injustice, the way in which this personal violence reflects the larger. I mean, I know it could be an obvious point, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's something that we really feel in our gut until we read a novel of this kind, like The Roundhouse.
Well, I think what has occurred is that there's a historical sense that from the very beginning in this country, Native women were somehow available sexually. You know, you look at the Pocahontas story, you look at all of the stories of the Wild West, and who were the people who were the protected ones? I mean, they were always the immaculately garbed white settler women. And it's the same with African American women. These were women who were somehow more sexually available from the beginning of American history. So that what I see now is history is present at all times. It feeds into the future. And I feel that the fact that this has been allowed to continue to occur has to do with a historical view of Native women.
Now, not all whites are equal. There's a wonderful character in this novel, Louise Erdrich, your latest novel, The Roundhouse. That's Linda Wishcob.
I love Linda. She's a surprise character. Sometimes a character just sort of becomes... She was a very, sort of dumpy, funny little person as she began. And then she became somewhat sinister with her porcupine hair and her little cute little fingernails, her pink fingernails. I mean, she just became more sinister as the book went on, and I really enjoyed her.
Yeah, but she doesn't seem to be ultimately that sinister. I mean,
she's good. She's
right.
Good. She just has a very clear take on the perpetrator of this crime, a very clear notion of who he is, so that by the end she's assisting Joe in what he feels he needs to do.
And she seems to have a very clear take on, I mean, she's white, but was adopted
mm-hmm.
by Native
she's
American
She's adopted
family.
By Native American people. And that's a story that's seldom told, but Native people have adopted non-Native people since the beginning, and I've heard so many stories like that. So this is just one instance in which she's adopted into a Native family, she's abandoned by her non-Native family, and she grows up as a Native person in a non-Native body, you know?
Right. Now, on a personal note, you wrote this book while recovering from breast cancer, is that right?
Mm, mm-hmm.
That's an incredible feat, I have to say.
Well, I was enormously supported by my family, so I couldn't have done it otherwise. My daughter, Palace, came home. She lives in New York. She came home and cooked and She cooked everything under the sun, so it was fantastic. You know, she really did that. And my family was so wonderful to me. And if anything informed the book, it really was this protectiveness that they felt toward me.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you, you know, I mean, when one's battling a disease like cancer, one is confronting one's mortality, mm-hmm. and kind of the bigger lessons of life are a little more vivid and intense.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any way in which you feel that your struggle had an impact and an influence on the writing of this book?
Well, I'm sure it did, but then again, I don't want to talk about it a lot because the issue in the book really isn't about me. But I know I went to this book for solace and that I took some very large emotions with me.
So I've heard you talk about revenge as being a theme in this book. I think it's a lot larger than that. But, of course, as we've talked about, when you are unable to get justice the normal way, then how do you get justice? You know, mm-hmm. What do you do? Could you say a little bit more about that?
I don't really think of it as revenge in this case. It's a case of an attempt to right or to save someone. I mean, it's not that it's a pure act of revenge. There is an attempt here to right a wrong, to make some sort of justice come out of a situation in which no justice can be found. It's a case in which this person is backed into a corner. And when that happens, the vengeance that one has to take is as brutally present for the rest of these people's lives, as much so as it is for the person who is the perpetrator of the crime. And that's not how it should be.
How should it be?
There should be justice. An appeal to justice should be made in the court system.
And tell us again the name of that law that now, coming into the world of nonfiction,
mm-hmm.
what is that law that was stymied by the House and hopefully will be reintroduced?
Well, the Violence Against Women, the Reauthorization Act, has been, it's very hard to say to support it right now because it's been gutted by the House. The provisions in it have been gutted by the House. So when it started out in the Senate, this bill was very much something that one could support. And at this point, the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act of 2012, it's House Resolution 4970, is something that has to be restored to its original form before it should be passed. And I don't know how that's going to happen.
Mm. Well, Louise Erdrich, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about this absolutely stunning new novel of yours, The Roundhouse. I highly recommend it to all our readers.
Thank you so much. And I should say that although, you know, I'm talking about it as a political book, I really fell in love with this relationship. It was such a human story to me, and I miss writing it.
Really? And are you working on another book?
Yeah.
Oh,
I am.
Great. Is it in the same family, the same place?
It will be in the same.
Wonderful.
Same series. It's a trilogy of books.
So you don't really have to let them go?
No, you're right. When I go home, I'll sit down and start working again.
Oh, great. Thanks again.
You. Such a joy to talk to you. Thanks.
That was my 2012 interview with Louise Erdrich about her latest novel, The Roundhouse. Thank you. right now, I want to tell you about a great opportunity to give a boost to our cultural heritage in the Pioneer Valley and help Writer's Voice. We have a grant from Mass Humanities for The River Runs Through Us, our special six-part series exploring the literature, spirit, and meaning of the Connecticut River in Massachusetts. We need to raise some funds to fulfill the conditions of our grant, and we've got a Kickstarter campaign to do it. So head on over to Kickstarter and search on The River Runs Through Us. Any amount of contribution is greatly appreciated. But we're not just asking for handouts. We have some wonderful rewards for your support, including new book titles and autographed books from local authors Susan Stinson and Jacqueline Sheehan. And check out the series at writersvoice.net. Finally, here's a clip from an interview we're airing next week. We'll be talking with financial journalist Helene Olin about her terrific exposé of the financial services industry, Pound Foolish. In Pound Foolish, you say that the personal finance industry has sold us on a dream. What is that dream, and who has sold it to us?
That dream is that we can, with good money management skills, invest and save our way out of bad economic trends like income inequality, income stagnation, and the society that's had a smaller and smaller safety net with every passing year, even as more and more responsibility for things like retirement and healthcare have shifted onto us. The who has sold us on this dream is everybody from the financial services industry to personal finance columnists to our politicians to pretty much anybody out there. We as a society believe very deeply in the myth of Horatio Alger, that anybody can get ahead. As I always like to say to people, Horatio Alger was a writer of fiction. In our society, we have massive inequalities that we are not addressing.
That's Helene Olin. We'll talk with her about her new book, Pound Foolish, next week. We'll also be talking with Les Leopold about his new book about hedge funds, How to Make $1 Million an Hour. Be sure to tune in, and thanks for joining us this hour. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.